Mr. President, Excellencies, Honorable Ministers, distinguished delegates, friends and colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. 10 years ago, the World Health Assembly met under a cloud of anxiety. SARS, the first severe new disease of the 21st century, was spreading explosively along the routes of international air travel, placing any city with an international airport at risk of imported cases. By early July of that year, less than 4 months after the first global alerts were issued, WHO could declare the outbreak over. Rarely has the world collaborated on so many levels with such a strong sense of shared purpose. Experience during the SARS outbreak sparked extensive revision of the international health regulations. These revisions gave the world a greater system of defense. It greatly strengthened the legal instrument for detecting and responding to public health emergencies, including those caused by a new disease. We are now dealing with two new diseases. Human infections with the novel coronavirus from the same family of SARS were first detected last year in the Eastern Mediterranean region. To date, 41 cases, including 20 deaths, have been reported. Though the number of cases remains small, limited human-to-human transmission has occurred, and healthcare workers have been infected. At the end of March this year, China reported the first ever human infections with the H7N9 avian influenza virus. Within 3 weeks, more than 100 additional cases were confirmed. Although the source of human infection with the virus is not yet fully understood, the number of new cases dropped dramatically following the closing of live bird markets. I thank China. I thank you for collecting and communicating such a wealth of information and for collaborating very closely with the World Health Organization. Chinese officials have promptly traced, monitored, and tested thousands of patient contacts, including hundreds of healthcare workers. At present, ladies and gentlemen, human-to-human transmission of the virus is negligible. However, influenza viruses constantly reinvent themselves. No one can predict the future cause of this outbreak. These two new diseases remind us that the threat from emerging and epidemic-prone diseases is ever-present. Constant mutation and adaptation are the survival mechanisms of the microbial world. It will always deliver surprises. Going forward, we must maintain a high level of vigilance. I cannot overemphasize the importance of immediate and fully transparent reporting to WHO and of strict adherence to your obligations set out in the international health regulations. As was the case 10 years ago, the current situation demands collaboration and cooperation from the entire world. A threat in one region can quickly become a threat to all. Ladies and gentlemen, the debate on the place of health in the post-2015 development agenda continues to intensify. The Millennium Development Goals strongly influence resource flows, competition among multiple sectors for a place in the new agenda is fierce, shall I say, very fierce. I ask member states to do everything you can to ensure that health occupies a high place on the new development agenda. Health contributes to and benefits from sustainable development and is a measurable indicator of the success of all other development policies. Investing in the health of people is a smart strategy for poverty alleviation. This calls for inclusion of non-communicable diseases and for continued efforts to reach the health-related MDGs after 2015. At the same time, I want to assure you that efforts to reach the health-related MDGs have accelerated during these last 1,000 days. This is especially true for women and children's health, and this is especially encouraging. Accelerating efforts to achieve these two goals mean accelerating efforts to overcome some very long-lasting barriers, barriers to service delivery to two very important groups of population, women and children. A new integrated action, global action plan for the prevention and control of pneumonia and diarrhea was released by WHO and UNICEF last month. The plan focuses on the use of 15 highly effective interventions. Each one can save lives. But when you put the 15 to work together, this is a powerhouse. A powerhouse that can revolutionize child survival. The newest vaccines and best antibiotics are included. But so are some time-tested basics, like breastfeeding, good nutrition in the first 1,000 days of babies, waters and sanitation, and the trio of vitamin A, oral rehydration, salts, and zinc. Equally impressive are the ingenious delivery solutions worked out by frontline workers for reaching the poor and hungry children who are most at risk. I find this integrated delivery approach an exciting way to move forward. The tremendous success in controlling the neglected tropical diseases clearly tells us the integrated strategies can stretch the impact of health interventions. And more importantly, it can stretch the value of the development dollars. Ladies and gentlemen, I am most pleased to inform you that well over 9 million people living with HIV in low and middle income countries are now seeing their lives improved and prolonged by antiretroviral therapy. This is up from 200,000 people just 11 years ago. And this is the fastest scale up of a life-saving interventions in history. And I want to thank all of you, countries who are supporting other countries. You have done a good job. WHO, on our part, progressively simplified testing and treatment approaches so that it can make delivery of high quality care in some of the poorest settings of the world possible. Prices of medicines have dropped, treatment regimens become simpler, easier to use, and more effective. Sites for testing and treatment move closer to people, to their homes, and they are trusted and used. The value of HIV treatment is now well recognized. When external funding has leveled off, domestic funding has stepped in to ensure continued scaling up of treatment. And this is very important. In June, WHO will continue to share with you our progress in simplifying things further by issuing revised consolidated guidelines for the use of antiretroviral drugs for both HIV treatment and prevention. Now let me turn to two important subjects too. For tuberculosis and malaria, once again, I want to thank all countries for the efforts you have put in. Recent progress has been encouraging, but it is increasingly clear to us we are threatened by the spread of resistance to mainstay medicines. All the gains that we collectively have achieved would go down the water, the tube, if we're not careful. Efforts, therefore, to stimulate the development of new medical products are critically important for every country in the world. The spread of antimicrobial resistance is rendering more and more first-line treatments useless. Some observers make the comment that we are moving back to the pre-antibiotic era. No, no, no. With few replacements in the pipeline, medicine is moving towards a post-antibiotic era in which many common infections will once again kill. Healthcare cannot afford a setback of this magnitude. We must recognize and respond to the very serious threat of antimicrobial resistance. Last month, I attended the Vaccine Summit in Abu Dhabi. Participants explore how the Global Vaccine Action Plan can be used as a roadmap. A roadmap to save more than 20 million lives by 2020 by expanding access to 10 existing vaccines. Polio eradication was given special attention as a milestone in this visionary roadmap. A comprehensive eradication and endgame strategy was issued last month, and it was discussed during the summit. Participants appreciated the strategy's many innovations and expressed the view that it has a very good chance of success. I agree. But I am fully aware of the challenge we face. Insecurity. Insecurity continues to compromise the eradication effort. We mourn the many polio healthcare workers who have lost their lives trying to deliver services. Importations continue to certain polio-free countries. As we are speaking, we are today responding to new outbreaks. Ladies and gentlemen, research, evidence, and information are the foundation of sound health policies for monitoring the impact and ensuring accountability. They keep us on track. The World Health Statistics report issued last week brings some extremely good news. The past two decades have seen dramatic improvements. Improvements in health in the world's poorest countries. Progress has been equally dramatic in narrowing the gaps between countries with the best and the worst health outcomes. The Millennium Development Goals, with their emphasis on poverty alleviation, have unquestionably contributed to these encouraging trends. We have a right to be proud. To be proud of recent achievements, but also of the many innovative mechanisms and instruments that were created in the drive to reach the goals. They brought out the best, the very best in human ingenuity and creativity. At the same time, I need to remind you that what lies ahead, especially as we tackle non-communicable diseases, is not going to be easy. No, it's not going to be easy. Let me repeat. Today's health challenges are vastly different from those faced in the year 2000, when the Millennium Declaration was signed. Efforts to safeguard public health face opposition from a different set of extremely powerful forces. Many of the risk factors for non-communicable diseases are amplified, and they are amplified by the products and practices of large and economically powerful forces. Market power readily translates into political power. This power seldom impeded efforts to reach the MDGs. No PR firms were hired to portray the delivery of medicines for HIV and TB as interference with personal liberties by the nanny state. And with WHO, you all know, depicted as the mother superior of all nannies. No lawsuits were filed to stop countries from reducing the risk from child mortality. No research was funded by industry to cast doubt on the causes of maternal mortality. Mosquitoes do not have front boots, and mosquitoes do not have lobbies. But the industries that contribute to the rise of NCDs do. When public health policies cross purposes with vested economic interests, we will face opposition. Well orchestrated opposition and very well funded opposition. WHO will never be on speaking terms with the tobacco industry. Never. At the same time, I do not exclude cooperation with other industries that have a role to play in reducing the risk of NCDs. There are no safe tobacco products, and there is no safe level of tobacco consumption. But there are healthier foods and beverages. And in some cultures, alcohol can be consumed at levels that do not harm health. I am fully aware that conflicts of interest are inherent in any relationship between a public health agency like WHO and industry. Conflicts of interest safeguards are very important, and they are in place in WHO, and they have been recently strengthened. WHO intends to use these safeguards stringently in its interactions with the food, beverage, and alcohol industries to find acceptable public health solutions. WHO will continue to have no interactions whatsoever, and I repeat, with the tobacco industry. As I said, this is not an easy time ahead. As just one simple example to share with you. Not one single country in WHO has managed to turn around its obesity epidemic in all age groups. Just this one example is enough for us to reflect on taking the appropriate policy options. The UN Political Declaration on NCDs clearly states that prevention must be the cornerstone of the global response. I agree. Yet even if prevention were perfect, we would still have clinical cases of heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and chronic respiratory disease. The response to NCDs depend on prevention, but also on clinical care. Clinical care which are cost-effective and financially sustainable. This is another challenge that lies ahead. Ladies and gentlemen, you will be considering three draft global action plans for non-communicable diseases, mental health, and the prevention of avoidable blindness and visual impairment. All three plans call for a life course approach, aim to achieve equity through universal health coverage, and stress the importance of prevention. All three give major emphasis to the benefits of integrated service delivery. Global strategies and action plans make an important contribution to international cooperation and coordination, and promote a unified approach to share problems. But sound health policies at the national level matter most. Public health has known for at least two decades that good health can be achieved at low cost if the right policies are in place. We know this from comparative studies of countries at the same level of economic development that reveal striking differences in health outcomes. Last month, a study from the Rockefeller Foundation revisited this issue with new data from a number of countries. That study leads me to a positive conclusion. Dear Member States, we are doing a lot of things right, on the right track. According to the study, factors that contribute to good health at low cost include a commitment to equity, effective governance systems, and context-specific programs that address the wider social and environmental determinants of health. An ability to innovate is also important. Specific policies that can make the greatest difference include, let me give you a few examples, a national medicines policy that makes maximum use of generic medicines and other products, and a commitment to primary health care, and the education and training of healthcare workers, which, ladies and gentlemen, is fast becoming a top priority in many countries in this organization. Above all, governments need to be committed, and they need to have a vision set out in a plan. This is also true for WHO. The 12th General Program of Work, which you will examine, sets out a high-level strategic vision for WHO with priorities and an overall direction. It aims to make the work of WHO more strategic, more selective, and more effective. For the first time, the proposed program budget provides a view of all financial resources from all sources, thus giving member states an opportunity to approve and monitor the budget in its entirety. Ladies and gentlemen, we are living in a deeply troubled times. These are times of financial insecurity, food insecurity, job insecurity, political insecurity, a changing climate, and a degraded environment that is asked to support more than it can bear. These are times of armed conflict, hostile threats among nations, acts of terrorism, and mass violence, and violence against women and children. Large numbers of people are living on edge, fearing for their lives. Insecurity and conflict mar several parts of the world, endangering the health of large populations. WHO is aware of reports of assaults on health personnel and healthcare facilities in conflict situations. We condemn these acts in the strongest possible terms. Conflict situations sharply increase the need for healthcare. The safety of facilities and healthcare workers must be sacrosanct. and I cannot emphasize that enough. Ladies and gentlemen, in these troubled times, public health looks more and more like a refuge, a safe harbor of hope that allows and inspires all countries to work together for the good of humanity. This is what you are doing, and we see the results. Fear of new diseases can unite the world, but so can determination. Determination to relieve preventable human misery. This is what makes public health stand out from other areas of global engagement. The motives, the values, and the focus. We know we have to influence people at the top, but it is people at the bottom who matter most. Nothing reflects this spirit better than the growing commitment in WHO member states to universal health coverage. Universal health coverage reflects the need to maximize health outcomes for everyone. Everyone, irrespective of their ability to pay, whether they are a woman, where they live, where they are from, should have access to the quality healthcare they need without risking financial ruin. A focus on universal health coverage continues the strong emphasis on equity and social justice articulated in the Millennium Declaration and in the Future We Want, the outcome document of the UN Conference on Sustainable Development. I am inspired by your commitment to universal coverage. Nothing gives me greater cause for optimism or a greater sense of pride and privilege to work as the head of this agency. I thank my staff for their dedication, wisdom, and experience. They are unbeatable. You don't agree? I thank my member states, my countries in this organization. I thank you for your dedication, your wisdom and experience, but above all, your passion about health, both at your country, regionally and internationally. I thank you for doing so much to improve the relevance, efficient performance and measurable impact of the work of WHO at all three levels of the organization. We need to keep doing the right things on the right track. The world's people depend on this organization for so much. And our work creates benefits that extend beyond health. By increasing fairness in access to care and equity in health outcomes, our work contributes to social cohesion and stability. And these are assets that every single country in the world would like to have. I encourage you to keep doing the right things on the right track. And it is my great privilege to support you. Thank you.